open a work session on House Bill 2022, and you'll note, I almost called you counsel, you'll note, committee members, that we have some dash one amendments. These, I believe, were at the request of the local governments and some of the things that we had suggested as well. I don't know if there's anybody that wants to give us any anybody out there to give us any information about the John, do you want to? I don't know if you have any information about the dash one amendments, or I was just looking through. We just got them this morning, but.
Good morning, Chair Carmel, and members of this committee. My name is John Phillips, and I'm with the Department of Revenue. And I did take a look at the amendments, and they are consistent with the suggestions we had made and others we had gotten and discussed in last in the committee in the last hearing. So we're, the Department of Revenue is fine with them.
Okay. And that sounds good. And I assume that the local government folks are fine with it. And I see heads nodding. Okay. Thanks, John. Good. So we would...
Chairman.
Yes, Representative Beck.
Move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2022.
Thank you. Representative Beck moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2022. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. The dash one amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Beck.
I move House Bill 2022 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Beck moves House Bill 2022 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any no discussion? Okay. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2022 is on its way to the floor.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
I recommend that we put 2022 on the consent calendar.
Okay. Representative Tomei moves that we put House Bill 2022 as amended on the consent calendar of the House. Is there any discussion, Representative Hill?
I think this is a pretty significant change. We might want to debate a discussion on the floor. So I would object.
Okay. So there is an objection to that. So that being the case, let's see. Who hasn't carried a bill? Representative Girard, would you like to carry this?
Certainly.
Okay. Great. Representative Girard will carry it. With that, I will close the. Because there's an objection.
Actually, Mr. Chair, members, I would suggest Representative Tomei might want to withdraw her motion. That would make it cleaner for the record.
Again.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Tomei has withdrawn her motion to put House Bill 2022 on the consent calendar. And so with that, it's on its way to the floor, and Representative Girard will carry. And with that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2022. Thank you. Okay. Let's see. I want to move into House Bill 2734. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2734. And I don't. Oh, wait, she's gonna go get it. House Bill 20. You want to get us a rundown on this one?
Mr. Chair, members, having not read this bill, I'll punt. Clarify the procedure for reassessing participants in a local improvement district. It looks like David Honeycutt is here. I believe. Is this your bill, David?
Yes.
Okay. David Honeycutt is here. He can explain.
Okay. Was Representative Starr planning on being here? Do you know?
No, Mr. Chairman. Chair Crumb, I don't think.
Okay.
Chair Crummell, members of the committee, Dave Honeycutt, Oregonians in Action, speaking in support of House Bill 2734, which makes a number of changes. The real heart of the bill, however, is contained in Section 2. To my right is Gordon Martin. Mr. Martin is involved in a a battle with the city of Tigard over a local improvement district issue, is here to answer any specific questions about his case. Just to provide background about this bill, but I'm not going to talk about the particulars of Mr. Martin's example. If the committee has any questions about his particular case, I think it provides a good reason for why House Bill 2734 is necessary. House Bill 2734 deals with local improvement districts. To understand the bill, you have to have a little bit of knowledge about a local improvement district. The letter that I handed out, and I hope you've all got a copy, I think does more justice than the presentation that I'm about to give you towards explaining essentially what this bill is all about. But a local improvement district is a method used by local governments to undertake capital construction projects to provide a specific benefit for a specific group of people. Street improvements are a good example of what a local improvement district would be used for. Let's say that there's a commercial district in a city, and the landowners and the business owners in that district decide that their businesses would improve if some street improvements were made in that generalized area. One of the tools that the local government has to make sure that those street improvements are made is to form a local improvement district. What will happen typically is that either the landowners will approach the city or the city will approach the landowners, say, we'd like to do some street improvements in this particular area. We think those street improvements will provide a particularized benefit to your properties. Therefore, we're going to propose a local improvement district to make those street improvements. And your properties, since they'll be specially benefited by that local improvement district, will essentially be charged with paying for the cost of those street improvements. Now, the way the system typically works, and I say typically because each city is and county is entitled to come up with its own set of ordinances to handle the procedures for a local improvement district. But typically, the way it will work is the district boundaries are determined. They determine which properties are going to be in the local improvement district. And then a public hearing is scheduled. The people whose property will be in the local improvement district are notified, and a cost estimate and a spread of the assessment is determined. So in other words, using our street example, let's say that there were five landowners who were going to be specially benefit from the construction of these street improvements. Well, what happened is the district would be formed with those five landowners essentially being the people in the district. Notice would be sent to those five landowners telling them that their land, that their property is scheduled to be included in the local improvement district. A preliminary cost estimate of the cost of the projects would be formulated. Let's use $1 million in our example just for sake of illustration. And those costs would then be spread. That $1 million worth of costs would be spread amongst those five landowners in some fashion. There's no set formula for determining how the assessments are going to be spread. Different cities use different formulas, and you'll use different formula based on the specifics of the project. But for sake of our example, let's say that the determination was made that the formula would be spread equally, or that the benefits would be shared equally amongst each of the five landowners. So they just spread it they just divided the $1 million by five and said, okay, each landowner is going to pay $200,000. At that initial hearing, with that information, the landowners have a choice. They can either remonstrate or object to the formation of the district, or they can agree to be part of the district. And typically, if there are enough landowners who object to the formation of the district, then the district doesn't get formed. And so you, as a landowner who owning land that in an area that's proposed to be part of a local improvement district, have a choice, and your choice is at the front end of the process. Your choice, based on the information you have, is essentially, in our example, would this project, would these proposed street improvements be worth $200,000 to me as a landowner? Would I be willing to pay that $200,000 for these improvements? If the answer to that is no, then you go in and object to the formation of the district, and you try and get enough other landowners to object that the project gets killed. If the answer to that is yes, then you would go in and you would either not show up at the hearing, or you would go in and support the local improvement district. The district would be formed, the improvements would be done, and then you'd be on the line for your $200,000. So your choice as to whether or not you want to be in the district and obligate yourself to make those payments is done at the front end. And the information you have at that front end will be a cost estimate, typically a cost estimate, and a proposed method to spread those assessments. The problem that arises, and what 2734 is designed to address, is the situation where after your chance to remonstrate against the district is over, when the district has been formed, the local government decides to change the spread of the assessments. One of two things happens typically. Either the total project costs go up. So in our case, let's say the $1 million projected cost actually turns out to be $2 million. And there, you know, in some circumstances you can expect that, and in some circumstances you wouldn't. But more importantly, and what House Bill 2734 deals with more precisely, is the spread of the assessments is shifted. So in other words, let's say that the project is actually completed on budget, and so we have $1 million total project cost, just as they estimated. What 2734 deals with would be a decision by the city council or the county commissioners, depending on who's in charge, to change the spread of the assessments so that instead of having 20% for each of our five landowners, where they're each paying $200,000, they would now switch it to, say, landowners A, B, and C are going to pay 30% each, and landowners C and D are going to pay 5% each. Well, landowners C and D love it because they were on the line for $200,000 and now they're on the line for $50,000. But landowners A, B, and C, who made their choice as to whether or not to go forward with the LID based on the assumption that they were going to pay $200,000 and or 20% of the total project cost, now we're looking at a bill of $300,000. Or in the case of the Martins, the change was more like $1 million. The difference was amounted to more like $1 million for the Martins. House Bill 2734 doesn't prohibit cities from shifting the spread of the assessments, from changing that. It simply makes it more difficult. And the purpose isn't to make things more difficult for local governments. The purpose is to make sure that landowners, when they make their determination about whether or not they're going to be in an LID, which is almost always an economic determination, don't see essentially the rug pulled out from under them and their decision undermined based on a change to the actual amount that they're going to pay based on a shift in the spread of the assessment. If you go to page 2, it's section 2. On page 2, it's lines 4 through 6. That's really the heart of this bill. And essentially what it says is in order for a local government to change the spread of the assessment, they have to make a finding that it's essential to achieve a substantial public interest or to avoid a substantial inequity. And what the bill does is it deletes the language, it is essential to secure an equitable assessment, and it adds that the language, it is essential to achieve a substantial public interest or to avoid a substantial inequity. There isn't any definition for those words, but we add it. Essentially, the bill adds the word substantial to public interest or inequity to essentially make it more difficult for a local government to change the way that they spread the assessment. And of course, the second thing that's on those lines 3 through 6 on page 2, it just adds the language, a change in the development pattern from that which formed the basis for the original estimated or final assessment does not constitute a substantial public interest or substantial inequity. What we're getting at there is the idea that if the LID is formed and the assessments are spread based upon what the city or county perceives the development to occur, that will occur in that area. Let's say they determine that it's going to be strip mall development in that area and it turns out to be big box retail. They're not able to switch the method of they're not able to switch the spread of the assessments based on the fact that what they originally envisioned changed. Instead of having strip mall development, they had big box retail. That shouldn't be grounds in and of itself to switch the method of assessment and make a landowner who made his determination.
Yes, Representative Hill.
I'm trying to understand here in terms of the real world experience, in terms of, I'm thinking back to when I sat on the city council and we did LIDs. It's 60% of the landowners within the LID have to approve it, and so you could have people who disapprove forced in it. And I'm just trying to get an understanding in terms of how the swing on assessing would change, because it was done on frontage when you're doing these things. I'm trying to understand in terms of how you could have a huge swing on the assessments based upon if you're doing a road improvement. What was the methodology that was used in the real world example in terms of that would swing the assessment on what would, you know, so because I'm getting a sense that it's either somebody is paying a whole lot less and somebody's paying a whole lot more, and it has nothing to do with how much, you know, frontage or value, you know, everybody gets out of it. Can you give me a sense in terms of what the decision process was?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Hill, to my right is Gordon Martin, who was involved in a specific case in the city of Tigard. He can address at least how they that case turned out. That'll give you a real world example.
Gordon Martin. Essentially, what happened was.
Excuse me, Chair. Are you representing the city, or?
No, I'm Gordon Martin, property owner, and working with Oregonians in Action on this bill.
You were part of this.
I was a part of the LID, the LID that was formed in 1985, a property owner, our family was assessed. In 85, the city, I'll briefly say what happened, used a zone method of assessment. So the land that was closest to the road was assessed at a higher rate than the land further away from the road, and it was divided into three zones of 150 feet. The A zone was assessed at three times the rate the C zone was. That was challenged by us in 1987, and the appellate court voided the assessment, sent it back to cure the defects. In 1988, the city reestablished the same zonal method of assessment, but cured the defects. Then in 91, what happened was is one of the property owners wasn't happy with that formula, proposed another formula which changed it to a gross area method, which essentially threw out the zone method of assessing land closest to the road at a higher rate further away, and just distributed the cost equally on per square foot per cost. So all the property owners were paying essentially the same rate per square foot of their land, and that shift pushed a lot of cost over to us in the amount of about $1 million.
Now, at the original formation of the LID, was the amount of land that you had, if you would have objected and remonstrated, would you have had the effect of getting out of or stopping the formation of the LID?
No. We held a minority interest at that time. So we could not have stopped the LID because there were other property owners that controlled over 60% or so of the district.
Okay. Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Henniker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Essentially, that's the guts of the bill, or they're in Section 2. Now, there are changes to the remaining portions of the LID statutes in Chapter 223, and that's the rest of the section. Essentially, those changes add the words new estimated or final assessment, or estimated or final reassessment. The purpose of that is to bring the rest of the provisions in Chapter 2, in the LID portions of Chapter 223, in line with 223.410, which is Section 1. The current version of 223.410 does, if a local government determines that there's a problem with their original LID, they're given a number of options. Number one, they can make a new estimated assessment. Number two, they can make a new final assessment. Or number three, they can make a reassessment. The remaining provisions of the LID provisions in Chapter 223, which are Sections 2 through 12, deal only with, at least arguably, deal only with reassessments. And so we wanted to make it clear and to prevent essentially a local government from saying we are going to change the spread of the assessments, but we're going to call it a new final assessment or a new estimated assessment and not a reassessment. And by putting that nomenclature on what we're doing, we essentially get out of the obligations of demonstrating that there's a reason that we're doing this. We're trying to avoid a substantial inequity or to achieve a substantial public interest. So the purpose of the rest of the changes is simply to get the remaining provisions of 223 of the LID provision sections of Chapter 223 in line with 223.410 and make sure that the changes in Section 2 of the bill apply regardless of essentially what the local government calls their subsequent action. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. And let me say, Mr. Chair, I had a conversation yesterday with Michelle Deister from the League of Oregon Cities. She and I talked. They've got some concerns with the bill. I think she's here to testify. I indicated to her yesterday that if it was acceptable to the committee, we'd be more than happy to sit down with them sometime next week. See if we can come up with some language amendments that address their concerns, and then bring this bill back if the chair consents for a subsequent hearing with some amendments.
Okay. Great. Thank you. Are there any questions for Mr. Honeycutt? Representative Girard.
Good morning, Dave.
Good morning.
A lot of times when local governments get involved in this type of a district, these estimates are initially just that, initial estimates. And from the time that the government entity establishes the price of the project as to its ending and the actual cost, there can be quite a difference. And I'm wondering how this bill would affect just local government's ability to estimate the actual cost of a project at an early stage.
Chair Crummell, Representative Girard, if you'll look at the guts of the bill again on Section 2, it's page 2, lines 4 through 6. What we're dealing with there is the change in the spread of the assessments. This bill deals with the change in the spread of the assessments, not the increase in cost estimates. So, you know, we understand that the initial estimate is that it's truly an estimate, and that there may be cost overruns, and the project may not come in at budget, and there may be some increases amongst the landowners in the amount that they're going to pay for the total project cost. At the same time, what we're trying to deal with is to prevent a shifting in the percentage that each landowner is going to pay, unless the local government can meet a fairly stringent standard of showing that they really need to do this. Because without that, if I was a landowner and that my land was proposed to be in a local improvement district, I would essentially automatically say no for fear that what the projected cost weren't going to be the actual cost, and it's hard to make an economic decision when essentially the everything that you base your decision on can change.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Brown.
When the LID was originally formed,
Don't the property owners participate, or the city make a decision then how the cost of the job is going to be divided and spread among the landowners?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Brown, that's correct. That's the way the system works. The problem is, and what 2734 deals with, is what happens subsequent to that. After the district is formed, the landowners don't have any option. You can't say, well, I changed my mind, I want out. And so once the district is formed, and the landowners have essentially lost their right to opt out, what 2734 tries to do is make it more difficult for the local governments to change the percentage that each landowner is going to pay, because the entire basis for your determination about whether or not you wanted to be in the LID is gone if they change the percentage that you're going to pay.
And so what you're saying is the property owner has the potential, if we don't make this change, they have the potential of getting stuck for a lot more than what they originally thought they was going to.
Chair Cromwell, Representative Brown, this is Exhibit 1 of that actually happening. So, yeah. The change for the Martins amounted to nearly $1 million.
Okay, thank you. Representative Tomei?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could you tell me if this bill had been in effect when this situation happened, what remedy would have been provided for you?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Tomei, the city of Tigard, in the Martins particular case, would have had to make a showing that the change in the spread of the assessment was necessary to achieve the substantial public interest or to avoid a substantial inequity. The law gives you an opportunity to challenge the current law, and it's not changed by this bill, gives you an opportunity to challenge that city's determination in circuit court via a writ of review. That's the process. But the actual standard for the city of Tigard would have been tougher. The other thing for in the Martins example, the city of Tigard wouldn't have been able to rely on the idea that the reason I use the example is because it's what happened here, that the type of development that was going to occur on the Martins property and the rest of the property in the district wasn't what actually occurred. They envisioned. They used a different method of assessment originally in the Dartmouth LID that the Martins were involved in, because they thought that there was going to be, I hesitate to call it strip mall type development, but development where there would be smaller shops right on the fronted, right on the with frontage right on Dartmouth Street. What actually ended up happening, if any of you are familiar with the city of Tigard, what turned out with Dartmouth Street wasn't small shops with frontage right on the street, but was Costco, Winco, and the big box retail, where the stores are set back and parking exists right along the front of Dartmouth Street. So what happened was the city of Tigard decided that based on that type of development, there needed to be a change in the method of assessment, which was fine for Costco and Winco because they saved money. But which essentially stuck the Martins with a million dollar extra tag, and coupled with the idea that you have 10 days to Bancroft bond, spread that payment over 10 years, and in order to Bancroft bond, you have to make your choice within 10 days. You have to waive all claims against the city, so they would have had to given up their right to sue the city of Tigard for those changes. In order to spread their payments out over 10 years, coupled with the fact that if they didn't Bancroft bond, the entire assessment, which was, what, 1.7?
It's about 2 million.
Yeah, nearly 2 million, would be due and payable in full in 30 days, with the city of Tigard having the authority to foreclose on the property at the end of those 30 days. So it's a real ugly situation. We were able to avoid that through the filing of the lawsuit and some negotiations with the city of Tigard, but that potential is out there, and so, frankly, we just don't think it's good public policy to allow for the changing of the spread of the assessments unless there's an absolutely critical need to do so.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Worth?
Hey, Mr. Chair, I actually have a number of questions, and I apologize for coming in late, so you might have had to repeat yourself, but particularly in regards to Mr. Martin's case, I think I understand you saying that the city had their original improvement district and the allocation based on the three zones, and that was challenged in court, and eventually a new reapportionment was adopted. Now, so was the reallocation of the costs based upon one of the landowners' objections and new, I guess, methodology for?
Well, there was a number of stages because this has a 17-year lifespan. The first challenge in 1986 resulted in curing of defects, and they reassessed in 1988 using the same zonal method. So I guess the direct answer to your question is no, there wasn't a change at that time. Then in 1990, they constructed the road and then reassessed in 91. And at that time, that's when one of the property owners objected to his assessment in a sort of a backdoor way and proposed another method of assessment that spread the percentages. You know, we're not talking about the cost, we're talking about the allocation or the percentage, and changed them or asked the city to change the method of assessment in 1992. So we went from the zonal method in 1985, and again it was the defects were cured in 88, and the city council reassessed, and then there was more lawsuits on condemnation, which wasn't involving us, and so in the 92 they changed to this gross area method, which changed the whole methodology or the formula that they used to actually spread the assessment, and shifting the percentages, as we're talking about, from, let's say, 20% to 35%. And of course, as you increase the percentage or your allocation, then the cost goes up, regardless of whether inflation has increased the price of the improvements. The point is that the allocation or the percentage changed too, because the methodology changed.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Representative.
So the city as a whole adopted this new methodology, and was that because the original zonal method then was not upheld in court?
No, the zonal method in 85, there was defects in it. They cured the defects, and in 88 they readopted it. The city readopted it, and we didn't have a problem with it at that point. Most of the defects were cured. Then in 92, they had a new assessment hearing and simply threw out the old zonal method that they had, in fact, adopted in 85 and again in 88. They just decided that it was not the right method based on their engineer. But I want to make one point that they didn't make, is that when the city council had their hearings, the councilors were saying, well, either assessment method could be fair. And so there wasn't this need to shift to the area method and throw out the zonal method. They were talking about, they were on the fence, and this is a quote, I'm on the fence on which way to go. So there wasn't an essential need to change the methodology. But they decided to in favor of the other property owner, and that, I know I may not be answering your question as well as you'd want, but there was a shift by throwing out the zonal method and changing to a gross area method, really based on, it was almost like a whim. Two of the councilors omitted themselves from the vote, and so the decision was made by three councilors, and they were going either way. So, am I answering your question now?
Okay, follow up? For a number of follow ups. That's exactly what I was trying to get at, is basically, I don't want to say pacify, but to alleviate the objections of the landowner that was to benefit more from this new allocation. So, kind of bending.
Right.
Whereas the zonal method had less objections. This one landowner was going to benefit more from the gross area, and so the city council to not have to deal with the objections of that.
Property, yeah. Right. And it's, by the way, I just wanted to add, is that the other property owner hired a consultant to come up with another methodology, and it turns out that the engineer for the city duplicated that methodology, including the heirs.
Now, can you tell me how often this happens where a governing body will change its, apart from the cost of the total project increases and therefore everyone's cost or amount that they have to pay for the improvement district increases, apart from that, how often is there really by the governing body an action by which the percentage of the total burden is reapportioned amongst landowners?
Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, I don't think anybody keeps those statistics. I certainly don't know.
Lee, I can answer part of that without a statistic so much as that we had one consultant that had been working on LIDs in different municipalities for 25 years, and he had done 1,500 LIDs ranging in value for $40,000 all the way up to a water district of $15 million. And he said not one time did they ever change the method of assessment once the formation and the original assessment method was established. Why? Because of the reasons Dave has given, is that the property owners rely on those estimates and the allocation and make their decisions. And in his entire career, it made the rest of us look like amateurs compared to this fellow. 1,500 of them, he's probably spread billions of dollars worth of assessments, and not once, and he testified in front of the city council on that, never once did they actually change it. And if they needed to, they went back and had a new formation hearing and gave the people a chance to remonstrate because there was a change in the rules of the game.
And that's kind of been what I get from my experience. I've been a planning commissioner for a number of years, and this is, we always estimate, you know, worst case scenario in terms of cost, and I don't certainly know a single case where this has happened, so I don't think it's widespread, but yet that doesn't diminish your case. Now, question in terms of the wording on line 4, page 2, can you give me an example of what a substantial public interest or a substantial inequity, what would fulfill that definition?
Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, the Oregon Supreme Court has determined previously, and there's not a lot of case law on the existing language, what's necessary to secure an equitable assessment. But the Oregon Supreme Court has determined previously that if the cost, and we're shifting to cost estimate as opposed to shifting of the allocation of the spread of the assessment. If a LID exceeds the original projected cost by 125%, it's time to call off. I believe the words of the Oregon Supreme Court are it's time to call a halt to the proceedings, and that's an oldie chestnut 1912 Oregon Supreme Court case. I don't recall. And we've briefed this issue substantially, that there are any existing cases out there that define what secure and equitable assessment is. So I believe that what will happen, since we're not asking that those words be defined in this bill, is that it would be determined on a case by case basis, and ultimately, at some point in time, as Gordon suggested, these don't happen very often, but ultimately if this issue happens and that issue arises, the Court of Appeals will determine what a substantial public interest or a substantial inequity means. I would, to give you an example of what I would perceived to be avoiding a substantial inequity. Let's say that that at the time the district is formed, the spread is going to be equal. I'm using my $1 million street improvements with 5 landowners. Each landowner is going to pay 20% of the total project cost. Subsequently, it's determined and listening to all the testimony, there was a mistake. Everybody understood at the time that instead of being 20-20-20-20 amongst the five landowners, it was going to be 30-30-30-5-5, and there was just the recorder or the ordinance was drafted improperly. That would, changing that wouldn't alter the expectations of any of the landowners who were belonged to the original LID. It'd just be correcting a Scrivener's error, and if you didn't correct that Scrivener's error, you'd essentially have a substantial inequity. So that'd be an example, but ultimately, these are going to be decided on fact by, you know, on case by case basis, and at some point, either the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court is probably going to be asked, or a trial court judge is going to be asked whether or not, given this set of facts, what they did was necessary to achieve a substantial public interest.
I'll follow up. And that's, I guess that's a concern of mine, that this doesn't give very clear and objective guidance to cities and counties as to what would substantiate these. What would be a clear or substantial, especially substantial public interest, thereby would be within their purview to take such action. But here's the question. Here's my last question. How long, do you have any estimates on how long typically the time elapses between the time an improvement district is formed and the improvements are actually completed? You know, apart from, you know, outlier case like Mr.
Yeah, Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, we don't want to use the Martin case because it was a 14-year project. Typically, I would guess that they're done fairly quickly. I don't think there's any data on that. I don't know if you know, Gordon.
They can. I've seen them go as quickly as 14 months because you have hearing and notice requirements. And then you have to do engineering, and then you have to hit a building season, and then a final assessment. So I've seen them as short as 14 months, and I think that's the exception. I think more like 2.5 years between the time you initiate it to the time the last plant on the sidewalk is put in. So,
yeah.
But it also depends on the size of the project.
Yeah.
If you have a $50 million project, it could take 10 years. If you're just doing a $50,000 project, it could be done in 14 months.
It's also dependent upon the scope of the project.
And I guess I do have one more follow-up.
Okay.
I'm trying to really make sure I understand line 5 and 6 regarding the development pattern. So if these, because, you know, linear commercial, you're basically going to have the same assessment, you're going to have the same improvements for whether that be mini mall or big box, whatever fits into that zone. So the only way I could see the development pattern really changing to the point where it would impact or change the type of improvements that are put in is, you know, basically rezoning. So linear commercial to maybe residential or anything. So if this, say that happens, say a property owner comes in and applies for a rezoning of the land, maybe to a greater level of commercial or whatever. So this would preclude that from being taken into consideration.
Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, that's correct. And the reason for that is because all of the owners in that district at the time that the district is formed make their determination about whether or not they're going to object to the formation of the district based on the facts as they are. And you can't expect a landowner to essentially see into the future and determine whether or not the development pattern is going to change, which would essentially make the original spread of the assessments change as well. Because we can't expect people to see in the future, it seems to me that to us that you the decision you originally make ought to be the decision that you're entitled to rely upon, and you shouldn't have to worry that your neighbor may come in and ask for a rezone from commercial to residential or vice, you know, or residential to commercial.
But you agree that basically you'd have to have a rezoning to constitute a change in the development pattern to the degree where your improvements, the level or type of improvements you would be required to make would change?
Chair Crummell, Representative Worth, I don't believe so. I don't believe in your specific situation that there was a rezoning.
No, there was no rezoning. There was a change in the expectation of how the land developed, but it stayed retail completely through the process. And if you did have that circumstance, and if the assessments hadn't actually been levied, you could actually go back, I don't know if I want to open up this can of worms, but you could have a new formation hearing, and people could argue that the rules of the game has changed, therefore now it's time to step back, reevaluate, and maybe there would be reasons to reallocate in a different methodology, but do it with a new formation to give everyone a chance to remonstrate from the beginning. Don't change the rules, at halftime, which is essentially what happened in our case. So reform the district and give the property owners a chance to, there was a change in zone or different expectations of what's going to be developed, reform and start the process over again, because they can kill an LID and come back and reform it and cure those defects that may arise. Do you follow what I'm trying to...
I do, but now I know I have another question.
Okay, Representative Worth.
How were the improvements, the actual infrastructure improvements, different from the beginning when the LID was formed and as development patterns changed into the final result? How was the infrastructure different?
That's a difficult question. Well, originally, in this particular case, the road was designed for three lanes, and it was found after some of our objections were considered that the road was actually not workable, and so it was changed to five lanes. So, and I know that this gets into a level of detail, but the point I'm trying to get at is that essentially the road and the curb cuts and the drainage and everything stayed the same. It was just widened a bit, and the cost really didn't go up. Matter of fact, the property owners that widened voluntarily, they paid for those improvements outside of the LID. They just did the actual improvements of the width, but the design, the alignment, and everything stayed the same. Am I getting to your question? The intersections were established and so on and so forth. It was just widened. So there was a change in the design of the road, but the costs and the allocations shouldn't have changed, because the property owners bore those additional costs individually outside of the district.
Thank you.
Representative Gerard?
Can you give me a couple of examples of valid reasons why local government would want to change the assessment spread?
Chair Crummell, Representative Gerard, since this doesn't happen very often, it's hard for me to come up with examples of situations, because obviously I don't think it was fair what happened in this case. It'd be hard for me to come up with an example of why they would want to change. The Scrivener's error that I talked about with Representative Worth is probably, is at least off the top of my head, is the only example that I can come up with.
I'll save the question for the next.
Okay. I would point out that with LIDs, you do look at the amount of benefit that each property, and I think that's what your questions were getting at, Representative Worth. You're looking at the amount of benefit that each property,
sure,
is going to obtain from the formation of the LID. And whatever formula you use for figuring out what the benefit to the property is going to be, even in a zone change, you would still have, potentially still have the same amount of benefit, irrespective of whether it's going from a commercial to an industrial, from a commercial to a residential type of use, the amount of benefit would probably still be substantially the same. And I think that's
right.
Just something to...
And just the level of improvement would change.
Right.
Our infrastructure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
But I think that those things have to be decided up front.
Right.
Not halfway through the game.
Exactly.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Representative Beck? I won't belabor this because I really want to move on, but if we come back to this, maybe some clarification will help the witnesses. But a quick question, do we have other examples of where this occurred, or is this a bill to fit one example? Not that that's wrong, but I'm just kind of
or anybody else asking for this?
Chair Cromwell, Representative Beck, I'm not aware of any other situations where this has occurred, and I think Mr. Martin's testimony is really on point on that, that this hardly ever occurs.
Right.
I don't think, from a public policy standpoint, however, that should conclude.
No, I wanted for the record, I want to understand that, and it leads to my next question and point. I think if we're going to create law by anecdote here, I think it's important that the committee get more factual details about this particular situation from the city. I would want maps. I would want to know how much property Mr. Martin owns, what his assessed value was. I think if we're going to create a law based on an anecdotal situation, I think it's really important for the committee to get all the information about that situation, get the city in here, and so that we understand this better if we're going to establish a broad public policy based on one micro situation. That's just, if we move this forward, that's what I'd like to see.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Michelle Deister.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Michelle Deister with the League of Oregon Cities. I, first of all, want to clarify that I am not here representing the city of Tigard. I'm not here speaking to that particular case or anything at all. I'm just here to talk about the bill in general. And I think, generally speaking, as you heard Mr. Hunsett say, he said that Section 2 was the guts of the bill. That is precisely the section of the bill which we have concerns with. You'll notice that Section 2 allows changes to the apportionment of the cost of improvements among benefited properties when, in the governing body's point of view, the change is essential to achieve a substantial public interest or avoid a substantial inequity. Well, initially, the bill appears to allow local governments some discretion in determining what constitutes a substantial public interest, but then it eliminates that discretion by stating, you know, by this qualifier that states that a change in the development pattern does not constitute a substantial public interest. And what we would say is that, you know, this seems very inconsistent, especially when you consider that decisions regarding development, zoning, and other comprehensive land use planning issues are within city authority, and municipalities do view these as matters of substantial public interest. I think, as you know, this bill definitely creates some uncertainties. It doesn't define things very well, and as Mr. Honeycutt mentioned, it could invite litigation if the definition of substantial public interest is ultimately, as he said, going to be determined by the Court of Appeals. And that's really what our issue is. And as he had mentioned, we had talked, and, you know, we're amenable to trying to sit down and deal with that if that is something that the committee is interested in, if they want to revisit this bill.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gerard, you had a question?
Michelle, I'm going to ask you the same question, but can you give me some kind of an example of why a city would change the assessment spread in the public interest? How would that benefit the public?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, as I think you've heard today, there have not been very many examples, except for this one, where this has occurred. So unfortunately, I don't know of any.
Follow up?
Yes.
I want to understand what you're saying is you can't think of any valid reason in the public interest that you would change the assessment spread.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, it's my understanding that local improvement districts are set up to apportion the benefits, and therefore that is how the apportionment is set up. And, you know, I would also point out that if you look in sections 4, 5, 6, and 7 of the bill, it talks to, I mean, it speaks to the fact that there are additional opportunities for a person to object to this process in the case of a reassessment. Now, what I think Mr. Honeycutt was getting at is the fact that not everyone will call it a reassessment, or at least, you know, maybe that was the case in the situation that he's dealing with. But, you know, I would say that there are opportunities, as the statute is written now, for the public to have additional input if you're talking about changing how things are happening.
Mr. Chair.
Reverend Gerd.
I just want to understand the League of Oregon City's position. You object to something that will probably never happen.
Well, I guess what I would say, Mr. Chair, Representative Gerard, is that, again, it's true this is limited, seems to be particularly limited to the city of Tigard, but it, I guess what I'm saying is that if this has implications for other cities, as we believe it might, then yes, I do object.
Okay. Any other questions for Ms. Dasby? Okay. Nope, I don't either.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, is there anyone else that wanted to testify? That's all the people I have on the sign-up sheet. Is there anyone else that wanted to testify on House Bill 2734?
Just looking at ours. He's happy over there on the side.
Okay. Seeing none, then I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2734 and would invite the proponents and opponents to get together on it. If there's a something that we could take a look at again, then please let me know. Thank you. Okay, with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 283. Can you give us a little rundown,
sure,
Kara? Sure. I can read it as well as I can.
Yeah, I haven't read the bill, so Senate Bill 283 removes the requirement that municipal corporations contract with accountants in the Oregon Board of Accountancy roster for purposes of developing, revising, and installing accounting systems. I believe the Board of Accountancy is here.
Okay. Let's see. Carol Reeves, and you're here, and come on up and
thank you.
Tell us what you know.
I know.
Or tell us what you don't know. You know.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Carol Reeves, and I am the administrator for the Board of Accountancy. And I thank you for allowing us this opportunity to discuss what we think is a small and non-controversial bill for you to think about today. It might take 5 minutes of your time.
We're all figured
out. I'm hoping that will be the case. The purpose of the board in requesting introduction of this bill is to remove some outdated language in the statute, and that language requires municipal corporations to use licensed municipal auditors to install, develop, or revise their accounting systems. Licensed municipal auditors, this is a license that is also issued by the Board of Accountancy, and it is a license that is awarded on top of the certified public accountant or public accountant license that they have already earned. So as you can imagine, the services of these people are rather expensive. It is the belief that this language was placed in statute at a time when we didn't have software. We didn't have technology that made accounting systems widely available without having to have special expertise. The municipal auditors are required to review the accounting system when they conduct the annual audits of municipal corporations. So their expertise in making sure that the accounting system includes any special expertise or special items that are necessary for the municipality is still present. That will not be lost. And the corporations are not required to use anyone other than a licensed municipal auditor. If they choose to do so, they may, but they will be allowed the choice of using other consultants. There are computer consultants, there are software engineers, or they may use software and install it themselves under this bill. It simply brings flexibility to the process and removes language that we believe is obsolete. Cannot define exactly, we believe that there is potential for fiscal impact. There may be cost savings to the municipal corporations depending on their size. depending on the complexity of their accounting system and depending on the resources that they have been using in the past to develop and assist them with their accounting system. But that's an unknown and an undetermined number that we really cannot predict. Thank you. If there are any questions, I'm happy to respond.
Okay. Are there any questions for Ms. Reeves? I have one.
Thank you.
And that is, do most municipal corporations now hire accountants or people with an accounting background as their budget officers or as their CFOs, so that you have chief financial officers, so that
Mr. Chair,
kind of your experience?
I really can't respond to that question with expertise. I believe it depends on the size of the municipality, whether or not they will have a licensed accountant on board as a member of their staff. They are all required to use a municipal auditor to conduct their annual audits.
Right.
In our information session, providing this information to municipal auditors, to our licensees, to let them know that the bill was going to be introduced, the responses that we had by telephone indicated that many municipal corporations and even licensed auditors did not know of this requirement. So there's a question whether, in fact, corporations were using their auditors to create or assist them with their accounting systems previously. Auditors would also tell us that, well, depending on the size of the corporation, I set them up with a set of Quicken Books. You know, I help set them up with that, and that's what they can use. So your range of needs is very wide because your municipal corporations are also varied in their purpose and their needs.
Great, thank you. Any other questions? Representative Kapori?
Thank you. This passed the Senate. Do we have an idea of what the bill was over in the Senate?
We might. And again.
I think there were three abstentions.
Sir, the vote, full Senate vote was 28 with two excuse, 28 aye.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other questions, Representative Wood?
Just one follow-up.
Yeah.
Is there any benefit at all in using the municipal auditors in terms of ensuring interface capability or anything between different systems or different locations of systems?
In the installation
right.
and development of systems, Mr. Chair, Representative Wood, I think that the expertise is still available as the auditor reviews and is involved with the audit itself on an annual basis. So I think that that is not lost. I think there is a benefit, yes, and I think that it is not lost through this change.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
To the question that I had asked, I saw Ms. Deister in the back of the room nodding that, yes, in fact, many of them do. So, anyway. Okay, with that, is there anyone else that wishes to testify on Senate Bill 283? Seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 283 and open a work session on Senate Bill 283. Representative Beck?
I move House Bill 280, or Senate Bill 283 through the House with a pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves Senate Bill 283 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Tomei.
Since Representative Hill isn't here, I recommend that this Senate bill go to the consent calendar.
Is that a motion, Representative? Thank you. Representative Tomei has moved Senate Bill 283 to the consent calendar of the House. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And with that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 283.
Good job, sir.
And now we will move into Senate Bill 285. And Kara, can you give us a little, you can read it as well as I can, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate Bill 285 increases the membership of the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries Governing Board from 3 to 5 members. And it specifies the members must be Oregon citizens and represent geographic regions of the state.
Okay. Good. With that, then we have John Bolio. Did I pronounce that correct?
Very good.
Because Kara whispered in my ear.
Whoa, that's so good.
She said Bolio. Very strong to watch.
The sweet nothings.
Whenever you're ready, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, being distributed now is a brief brochure on the department, but inside is a summary of my testimony. I'll try to take just 5 minutes of your time also. All states have geology departments. All countries have geology departments. Basically, they're in place to provide unbiased scientific information so that society can solve problems, hopefully on an objective basis and in a cost-effective manner. My board currently has 3 members. They function as the body that approves our strategic plans, our budget. They pass on all of our rulemaking, and they provide a conduit for public input into the department. They serve as the Oil and Gas Commission for the State of Oregon, as the Geothermal Commission for the State of Oregon, and they oversee the regulation of the natural resource side of mining in the State of Oregon, and they guide our geologic survey efforts. We've been an agency in the state for 64 years and have had a 3-member board for that period, but a lot has changed over the years. And we're finding that as our activities become more relevant to the state with the discovery of earthquake activity or with more mines and with coastal erosion, things like that, we can serve the public better if we have 2 more board members. There'd be more access to the board. We'd have more opportunity for subcommittees to deal with issues that people bring to us. We also would be able to get rid of some procedural problems. For example, in the current situation where we have just 3 members, 2 of them can't even talk to each other on the telephone between meetings to say, what was your policy position again, without violating the Open Meetings Act. So we have little problems like that, but we also, the broader issue is one of just a, I think, an expanding presence of the agency given the needs of the state, just the need and the desire to do a better job. I think that pretty much covers my points. This bill passed the Senate 28-0. And as noted also by Carol, we want to maintain the focus of the board membership to be on just civic-minded, involved members of communities scattered around the state geographically, without any statutory reference to their particular interests, their particular, whatever their particular interests are, because we would like not to have specific points of view planted into the board by statute. It kind of goes against the notion of unbiased. There's certainly no reason why interest groups can't be on the board. We would encourage that, but we just don't want to have a statutory splitting of the board that makes it difficult to staff it or to get members. So that's the core issue here, and I'll answer questions.
Okay, great. Are there any questions?
Not really a question, but I think just from the public meeting law perspective, I think you have to do this. I mean, I know there are other reasons here, but for the fact that 2 board members can't talk to each other, I think it's absurd. Yeah. And from that perspective alone, I think we need to do this.
Same plan board.
Okay. Representative March, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I certainly agree with my esteemed colleague about the number of members, but I also, in describing this, you talk about the all geographic regions of the state. I mean, technically, you've got 3 folks now. You're going to have 5. So what are the 5 geographic regions of the state?
It's really interesting. And one of the reasons we're playing into fairly flexible language here is that there will be times when Eastern Oregon, for example, is the focus for a number of years of maybe the major policy attention of the state. Recall the heap leach mining discussion in the late 1980s, early 1990s. Ideally, we probably would have had 2 people from Eastern Oregon during that period. You know, that could have been a playout. At other times, we've done a lot of earthquake work, for example, in the Portland area, creating a tremendous amount of maps and dealing a lot with the public there. Maybe at that time, it would have been nice to have maybe 1 or 2 from the Portland area. So I think I can't name 5 geographic regions of the state. I can perhaps name 8 or 4 or whatever, but the way it really plays out is the governor's office has a file of people who want to be on our board. The number has ranged from 2 to 80 at any time. And when they're looking into that file to replace somebody, if they're guided to keep an eye on the geographic spread, they might be more apt to pick one over the other based on that.
I guess that's, I hope, does that answer your question?
Yeah, follow up.
Yeah,
thank you. Where are your members from now, I guess, would be another.
Yeah, currently we have, of course, three members. One is from, gosh, my mind goes blank here. One is from Northeastern Oregon. And then we have actually, currently at this present time, we have two that reside in Salem. But it's a very unusual situation in that one of them thinks she's in Eastern Oregon because that's where her roots are and that's where all of her phone calls come from. She's a former employee of the legislature here, Barbara Seymour of Legislative Council previously. I think she was there for about 30 years. And the other person represents the coast, Don Christensen. He's also on the Marine Board and he's been with us for a number of years. And today, in fact, he wanted to testify, but he's over on the coast dealing with some issues on behalf of the department. And he resides in Salem temporarily for some very personal and tragic reasons, but he represents the coast. So, again, I don't want to get, I would hope that we don't get too precise on the language here because it starts going counter to the real world when it comes to filling those positions.
Mr. Chair, just a second. Representative Gerard?
John, I just wanted, since the 1993 earthquake in Klamath Falls, I know we've seen a lot of dog ammy in Klamath, and I just wanted to express my appreciation and the appreciation of the people in our district for the information that dog ammy has given us to help us prepare for hopefully will not occur.
Yeah. Chair Crummell and Representative Gerard, we've enjoyed rediscovering the fact that Klamath County actually is part of Oregon and have actually went for several decades without doing much work in that part of the state. And nothing like an earthquake to get our attention, and currently we're working quite a bit with the Watershed Council there as well, trying to deal with what we can contribute to the water solution down there. So we've been working a lot with some of those people also.
I'm a fault in Oregon.
Representative Beck? Well, I just thought that if you're going to have five geographic areas, you could have Portland, Metro Portland, Washington County, Clackamas County, and Multnomah County. That seemed like that would work.
That's basically what half of the population of the state already thinks. So.
Just some comic relief for the morning.
Thank you, Representative Beck.
Just show
your next act, you'll do. Are there any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Work session. Linda, bye.
Good morning, Chair Crummell and committee members. My name is Linda Bai. I represent OCAPA, which is Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. Mm-hmm. I'm here to support and show you our support for Senate Bill 285, which increases the Dog Ammy Governing Board from 3 to 5 members. We agree with everything that John has said this morning, that he's definitely got some tough issues to deal with in terms of just the open meeting violation law. But anyway, OCAPA just wants to show that they support Senate Bill 285.
Good. Are there any questions for Linda? I would just point out that this is one reason why the state land board has to have staff that talk to each other, because right. They can't talk to each other about any of the state land board issues because there's a
change in that.
Okay.
They don't talk to each other anyway.
Thank you very much. Okay. Is there anyone else who wanted to testify on Senate Bill 285? Seeing none, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 285, and I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 285.
Chair.
Representative Beck.
Move Senate Bill 285 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beck moves Senate Bill 285 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Tomei.
Taking advantage of the fact that Representative Hill is still absent, I would like to recommend that the Senate Bill 285 be placed on the consent calendar.
Okay, Representative Tomei moves Senate Bill 285 to the consent calendar of the floor. Are there any objections?
With all due respect to my colleague from Milwaukee, I do think that this is a sort of change. It's probably worth not worthy of a problem. It will probably not excite floor discussion. I think it's important for the members to hear that one of their state boards is expanding membership. I think it's an important discussion to be heard on the floor. Maybe that speaks to my antiquated seniority here in the House, but I do think there's some value to our floor debates, and I'm a little more reluctant to just throw everything on the consent calendar.
I also will object.
Okay.
That takes care of that.
Would you like to remove your remove or withdraw your motion? Let the record show that Representative Tomei has withdrawn the motion, in spite of the fact that Representative Hill is still not here.
Mr. Chair, I object to the impugning of the character of my esteemed colleague.
No, we're not. I wouldn't dare.
Chair, I will volunteer to be carrier and to be expeditious in my duties in that capacity.
Terrific. Then Representative Beck will carry the bill on the floor. Great. Thank you very much. With that, I will close the work session on Senate Bill 385. And is there anything else that we need to discuss before we adjourn? Seeing nothing, we stand adjourned.